In his first letter, John says that the reason the world does not know us is that it did not know God. World, in this sentence, designates those who do not understand Christians because they do not believe in God. But can Christians themselves claim not to belong to the world too? Can they say that they know God, and hence that they fully know themselves? The reality is that even for Christians, God remains a mystery, and that they too keep on resisting God and replacing him with idols. And to the extent that they too do not know God, they also are prevented from knowing who they really are. Read from the viewpoint of Christians, this same sentence could be phrased as follows: the reason we are a mystery to ourselves is that even if we believe in God, we remain part of that world which resists to God. We start knowing ourselves only when God reveals himself to us. According to the book of Genesis, we are a lump of clay that is alive because it breathes God. He formed us from the dust of the ground and breathed into our nostrils the breath of life, and we became a living being. A lump of clay stays there, does not go anywhere. A lump of clay that breathes God is set on a journey, is given the hope of and the task of becoming like God, of sharing in God's freedom, which is the freedom to love and live despite the countless hindrances we are crippled by in a physical and emotional everyday life. The true nature of this lump of clay breathing God was manifested one day when Jesus was transfigured before John. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. What a hope, to shine like the sun. Yet, this is exactly what we are promised. He will transfigure our lowly bodies, the lump of clay, so that they will be like his glorious body. John kept meditating on this experience. Curiously, unlike the three other gospel writers, and despite the fact that he was there to see it, John does not mention the transfiguration in his own version of Jesus' good news. This omission speaks loudly, and is one of the reasons why John is the model of contemplation. One of the refrains of his gospel is, "We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." Now, the English translation for seen here is too weak. The Greek is theaomai and means gazing at, beholding, and could be translated contemplate, as French and Italian translators of this passage have done. John does not give a report of the transfiguration as a discrete event because he sees Jesus transfigured throughout his life, because he has eyes that can discern and contemplate Jesus' glory. The Jesus of John cannot contain the light that shines out of his person, his words, and his actions. It was possible to contemplate the Spirit coming down from heaven as a dove and remaining on him. From the very beginning of his mission, when the water became wine at the wedding in Cana of Galilee, Jesus began to reveal his glory, to radiate his light. Crucially, this glory, this light, shines through Jesus precisely when he is at his most human. This appears, for example, in the episode when he is overcome by emotion at the death of his friend Lazarus and shares the sisters' grief. That also is the moment when his glory shines through. We are told, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" Even more tellingly, the suffering and death of Jesus on the cross, when he was so disfigured that he no longer looked like a man and many were horrified by his sight, is for John the moment when the light radiating from him reaches the highest luminosity. These are the words John puts on Jesus' lips just before he hands himself over to his killers. And now, Father, glorify me in your presence with the glory I had with you before the world began. This now, that is the time of his passion, is the hour of the full manifestation of his glory, because then he gives us the greatest proof of his love for us. It was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave the world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. As for what loving to the end means, he made it clear when he said, "Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends." Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. This is the glory Jesus wants to share with us. He says, "I've given them the glory that you gave me." This is the light we too can radiate. This is our hope, the object of our thirst and our desire, what we are promised. "Father," says Jesus, "I want those you have given me to see my glory." John teaches us what authentic contemplation does to us, how it allows us to outrun not only Peter, but also Mark, Matthew, and Luke in the ability to see and believe, how it kindles our desire and thirst for God. We are invited to contemplate how much we have been loved. See what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are. Thus, as long as we have not been given eyes that can gaze at this love, as long as our heart has not been enabled to feel it, we are still of the world. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know him. The reason we do not know ourselves is that we still do not see as the Father sees us. We are still unable to sustain the sight of this light, just as John too failed the first time he beheld it. He too, at the Transfiguration, fell face down to the ground, terrified. He overcame this fear only when Jesus touched him and said, "Get up, don't be afraid." John never forgot this touch. Never again was he afraid of Jesus' glory, because this touch taught him that the light was the sign not of God's power, but of his love. And from that day on, he boldly stared into it, dazzled at first, but then, little by little, increasingly able to recognize it in every aspect of Jesus' life, in every page of Scripture, in every movement of his heart, in every moment of his life. From that day onward, he lived in this hope. Dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known. We know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. We are a lump of clay breathing God, thirsting for God, seeking God, desiring God, because we have this hope. Whatever obstacles to loving and letting ourselves to be loved we stumble over in our life, they are powerless against this hope. Whatever darkness, doubts, blindness, fear might try to prevent God's light from shining on us, from transfiguring us, we are promised that we shall be like him, that we too are in the process of being transfigured, and that this is happening now. Can any of the many promises contained in Scripture be more consoling than this one? We shall be like him. Is this not what we have craved for from the beginning? Is it not for having coveted it in the wrong way that we jeopardized our place in God's garden and lost it? "Certainly you will not die," the serpent said to the woman, "for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God. But this was a lie, and instead we died. Our eyes became incapable of sustaining God's light anymore, and we found ourselves exiled from the garden, lost and confused in a dry, a weary land where there is no water. To be like God was the desire, the thirst that lost us. Not because it was the wrong thing to desire. On the contrary, the innermost drive of our heart is to become like God because we are created in His image and likeness from the beginning. What we tragically misunderstood is how we get there. We thought we could snatch it like an apple from a tree. Let us assume it was an apple. We did not realize that we can become like God only by breathing Him, by contemplating His glory. The way John's Gospel expresses this truth is by inviting us to remain in God like branches that firmly cling to the vine. I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener, says Jesus. You are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. We become like God by remaining in Him, aware that He lives in us, that He has never ceased to remain in us. Remain in me, as I also remain in you, says Jesus. And the way this happens, the way in which we remain in Him and discover Him remaining in us, is by nurturing His words in our heart and letting Him love us. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, says Jesus, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. And He says again, as the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. Combining these scriptural images, we can say that contemplative prayer is just this: breathing God, remaining in the Father's love, allowing God's words to take root in us and thus grow into likeness with God until we shall be like Him. This is the hope that fuels our desire, renews our thirst, drives our search, but also purifies them. All who have this hope in Him purify themselves just as He is pure, says John. This is the hope that gives us eyes able to contemplate God's light. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God, they will contemplate God. A purity which is not absence of darkness, of course, of sins, of contradictions, wishfulness, hesitations, doubts. No purity of this kind is within reach in this life. Rather, a purity which we receive only insofar and for as long as we see, contemplate, believe, trust what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are.